Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 168 for October 12, 2012. Debunking all those ethanol myths. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter DeLorenzo.
John McElroy.
Good to be here, man. It's been a while for me.
It has been a while.
Geez, I was out at the Paris Show, and then I was out at the Global Leadership Conference in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia last week. So.
Where the double secret cave is.
Right, the bunker.
Yeah.
And we got Drew Winter with us tonight, too,
yep.
From Ward's Auto World, the
yep.
editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
Good having you here.
Great to be here. So how was the conference?
It was a good conference. I learned a number of things there, and... And in fact, we can get into some of that in a minute, but the topic I'm dying to talk to Peter about was something that I pounced on as soon as it was announced, and he wrote his column about it, and he was ranting this week. And that, of course, is General Motors appointing a new head of Cadillac globally, whose background essentially looks to me like a lobbyist.
No, not essentially. He is a lobbyist, and... By all accounts, a decent guy, a smart guy,
mm-hmm.
and was serving GM well in Washington in that role.
And had done it for AT&T before that, right?
Yes, the connection, the telecom connection is there.
Right.
But a bit puzzling.
Very puzzling. My word was curious.
Yes.
It was a curious choice.
Well, I think this is obviously someone that has access frequently to the CEO, Dan Akerson, and he probably impressed Dan. And Dan's kind of he's really on a jihad to not do anything like GM used to do, even though about 80% of what GM used to do was pretty damn good. They usually mix it up at the wrong levels at certain points, but the product people certainly have kept GM in the mix. And I think Akerson likes to shake it up. But this makes no sense. I don't care how smart the guy is or how nice he is, and I'm sure that's all true. But leading a global automobile brand in this day and age requires an awful lot, a lot of meaningful experience, which he doesn't have. And I don't get it. I think it sends the wrong message to the rest of the organization. And, for instance, Don Butler.
Right. Who is the chief marketing guy, at least in the U.S. for Cadillac?
Yeah, I would think he has a pretty strong grasp of what Cadillac is right now and where they want to go. At least every time I've talked to him, he seems to be on point. He seems to understand their limitations. But that he also knows where they need to go. He was completely passed over. Now, of course, there's going to be a global leader for Chevrolet, and I wince at that. It better be somebody who's really knows what they're doing. I think this has changed for the wrong reasons, and it's going to hurt Cadillac. And, since I wrote my column, I've sat back and thought about it, and I wasn't going to, I have a tendency for me to rant and rave tonight, but really it's just... I got to just shake my head. I don't think it's a good move.
No, I totally agree. I don't know. How do you read
it? Well, it's reminiscent a little bit of the Jack Nasser days at Ford, where he had this habit, again, he wanted to shake up the culture. And he had this habit of finding people, that would impress him and giving them these giant promotions or giving them all sorts of power. And they were almost always a disaster. And then he had his ideas about the GE system of automatically firing people to sort of cull the ranks and create a culture of excellence within Ford, it all was terrible. I mean, it just didn't fit with the automotive culture.
It didn't work.
And I'm just afraid that this is the same sort of trend where as Peter says, he's trying to shake up the system, fine, but I'm not sure this is the right way to do it.
Well, GM has, there's a precedence for this in the John Smale era. And John Smale was
another example.
Was obviously a P&G guru, and you know, and he brought Ron Zarella on, and they really truly believed that even if they had an inferior product, they could market their way to success, and that was proved to be absolutely wrong. They brought a bunch of people who were ill qualified to become brand leaders, you know, brand management leaders, and you know, and that it, that worked terribly. I mean, that set GM back a decade. And I see another thing coming on just like it. And once again, you know, GM is, you know, they've got great product. They got great product people. The true believers at GM do great stuff, design, engineering. But once again, it's this, oh, we're going to change this. We're going to come up with this new idea. And they've been doing that for 25 years now. And every time they get into it, they set themselves back. Now is the time to focus on product above all else. Now, if, is it Robert Ferguson?
Yeah, right.
He's following me on Twitter, by the way. Hey, Bob. you know, if he... maybe has some uncanny product knack, but I don't...
Look, I don't see it at all.
I don't see it at all.
I was talking to a former BMW vice president who was, like, astonished at this move. He didn't get it at all. Couldn't understand why a brand that is fighting tooth and nail and has got to grow globally would put somebody in charge who has no experience in this whatsoever. Yeah. He said, you got to understand, these guys at BMW... they've got to fight their way in around the world to get assignments in Latin America, North America, Europe, Asia Pacific, Africa, you know. And only when they have this great body of global experience do they get into a position like that. And his question was, why didn't they go out and try to steal somebody from Mercedes or Audi or BMW? Well, you know, if they want to shake things up.
That's what Carlos Ghosn did when he hired Johan de Nissen away from Audi.
Right.
Now, Johan, now there's an experienced...
Yeah.
leader of a car company, and they went and stole him to run Infiniti. That's the kind of move you make. This kind of move is just doesn't make any sense, and it really sends a wrong message to the product people.
I agree. I don't think it's going to last in the long term. I don't want to make predictions. I'll stick my neck out, though, and I'll say by 2015, he's not going to be there. I just don't see this thing working.
Well, I've heard Ackerson's leaving at the end of 13. Come hell or high water, so you know, remains to be seen.
Sometimes having to have gasoline in your blood, you know, is overdone some. I mean, I think we all said that with Mulally. You know, when Alan Mulally came in, everybody's like, oh man,
Don't forget though, Alan has manufacturing experience, serious manufacturing experience.
And engineering, and used to doing global engineering projects.
Wait,
which
but
really...
more than that, remember, Alan brought in Lou Veraldi, who ran the original Ford Taurus program back in 86, because he loved what Lou was doing with Team Taurus, as they called it.
Yeah.
So he started to learn more about what Team Taurus was doing. That got him turned on to the Toyota production system, but... here's the big difference. Alan is running a corporation. He's not in charge of sales, advertising, and marketing.
Yeah.
You know, throw him into that job and see how well Mulally does. I'll bet he wouldn't do all that well. It's a total different animal of being the CEO of Boeing's commercial division and then being CEO of Ford Motor Company versus trying to figure out what's the best way to advertise, market, and sell these cars. Totally different ballgame as I see it.
Yeah. I think Peter, that whole sorry era GM was so misguided, and they took very bright people, but they were all going to say, okay, we're going to use data and all these metrics and everything to sell these products, and oh God, that was a disaster.
Well, it's too bad. I mean, Cadillac, you know, they've got some serious products, the new ATS. You're driving one?
Right. Yep. I love the car. I think it's a terrific car.
You know, they've got the big sedan coming, you know, basically the sedan version of the CL that's coming in 2015. I don't know. It's not good.
It's not good.
Can this be traced back to the debacle there with buying the advertising with the soccer team and all that stuff, where we go back to, was there something there that happened that maybe made them say, oh God, we got to go in a totally different
I don't think
direction?
So, because remember, they brought Joe Lewanek in from the outside too. You know, they stole him away from, well, from Nissan, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think
I was about to say Hyundai.
I actually think that soccer deal is going to prove to be a outstanding deal.
Okay.
Over time. That was purely a chemistry clash there. Mm-hmm. There was no, like, evil doings going on. That was purely a chemistry thing. And if Mr. Erickson doesn't like your chemistry, you're not going to stay. Well, that's pretty clear.
So let's talk about another disaster, the Talladega NASCAR race, where on the last lap, smash, crash, bang, three-quarters of the field gets knocked out. And, you know, this is starting to irk me that NASCAR holds these races on these super speedways, Talladega being the primo example of, you know, there's just going to be a gigantic accident. I mean, a giant one.
And news came over the wire today that Dale Earnhardt Jr. Exacerbated a previous concussion in the wreck that no one knew about, the previous concussion, which he suffered in a testing accident in August when a tire blew. But he's got to sit out two races. But the thing about this is NASCAR's default defense of the restrictor plate tracks is always, well, you know, the fans like it. Well, they lost their biggest star, Dale Earnhardt Sr., in 2001 at Daytona. And they went on this, you know, this mission to make their cars safer, which they did. It was all well and good. But, you know, every time they go to a restrictor plate track, because they won't take the steps to change the style of racing, they're playing Russian roulette.
Right.
They could lose another driver. If you look at that crash over, there was two or three guys who could have been seriously hurt in it. They were lucky. They seem to be lucky every time. But that's, and then their default, like I said, their default defense, you know, the fans like it. I don't think the fans like, you know, I don't think the fans like seeing a 500-mile race with basically formation flying around the oval for 488 miles, and then they're all hell breaks loose. I don't think real fans like that. And they won't take the steps and the steps really come down to much smaller engines, less power, you know, take the restrictors off so that the drivers can actually use the throttle. But, you know, they need to slow the cars down by 20 miles an hour. Now, why do they need to do that? Because in 1985 or 87, Bobby Allison went into the catch fencing in Talladega. And it was just pure luck.
Didn't kill a bunch of spectators.
Because racing goes back to 1955 with the disaster at Le Mans when the Mercedes-Benz careened off a car in the front straight and went into the crowd and killed 88 people. Racing basically stopped in Europe after that, except for Formula One. Racing cannot survive that type of horrendous accident. So NASCAR's response is, well, that's why we have restrictor plates, because if we took the restrictors off in the current aero package, the current horsepower, because those motors will make 850 horsepower, they will lap at 230 miles an hour at Talladega. Well, if you do that and there's an accident, it goes in, they're going to, you know, they're trying to avoid the big one that goes into the crowd and brings racing to a halt. I say maybe take about 30 rows of seats out of there, but lower the car's horsepower, give the control back to the driver with full use of the accelerator, no restrictors, and let them run that way. But the way they're going now, they are eventually the luck's going to run out.
I agree.
And now this is a live televised sport. It happened when Dale Earnhardt Sr. was killed, although, you know, no one knew, you know, how bad it was. But, you know, they're just playing with fire.
you know, even if it was totally safe, to me it's just, it's kind of dumb to have a race where you just know, you know there is going to be a big crash.
Well, just the fact that people don't understand, I mean, and I always say this, you know, if you all you do is watch racing on TV, you don't have any idea how fast these guys are going. And it's a miracle that they even survive without multiple big ones in a race, because they're driving around within inches of each other at 210 miles an hour, lap after lap.
In fact, a lot of times you don't even have the sensation of speed until they do crash.
Yeah.
And then you realize, wow, it takes them an awful long time to slow down.
Yeah, so NASCAR, their position, as far as I'm concerned, is indefensible.
Yeah.
Indefensible. They have got to address this.
Right.
Now, they've got all new cars coming in 2013 that are production, really actually very nice-looking cars, but they find out, gee, they're going a little faster. They're more aero. I mean, they got to do something about it, because they cannot afford to have one of their stars, you know, lose their life when they can, you know, they can take steps to avoid it.
Right. Absolutely.
It's just ridiculous.
Well, as someone who doesn't follow NASCAR closely, I mean, what really drives NASCAR in terms of revenue and what forces them to create the product they have? I mean, are they really doing it for the true fans? And that's, you know, the true fans want pure racing, want, you know, would they be happy with the slower speeds? Or what, you know, how did it get to this state now where you say it's so dangerous?
Well, I mean, you know, NASCAR had its peak in 2007. It had about a five-year period where it was just...
It was the biggest thing.
Yeah, it was on the front page of Sports Illustrated, NASCAR Nation. I'll never forget that cover. It was just like, wow. Yeah, but subsequently, the ratings have declined. In-person attendance. Now that's an interesting thing. Nate Ryan in the USA Today pointed out, and he's one of the best writers in the business. He pointed out that there were 88,000 people at Talladega.
That's nothing.
Whereas before, it would be 130 all day, every race they had. There is clearly something wrong. How did they get to this point? I don't really know. I think they've addressed a lot of issues in NASCAR, but they have failed to address the restrictor plate tracks. It's their biggest tracks, their showpiece events, the Daytona 500, Talladega, and yet they can't seem to really step up and say, you know what, this isn't really working.
Right.
And their star driver, Dale Earnhardt Jr., is going to sit out for 2 weeks after the race, said, I don't know why we're doing it.
Right.
You know, this isn't racing, never has been racing. And all the drivers say the same thing, but, you know, they're contractually, that's what they do. None of them are happy about it. Not one of them. And that's just really a bad way to go.
Because it's my impression that personalities, right, drive some of the fans.
It's a personality-driven series.
Right.
Followed by major sponsors and followed by the manufacturers. The manufacturers are still the lifeblood of the thing. But they get sort of short shrift in this, although that's why they sort of called NASCAR into a meeting and said, we're not running these cookie-cutter cars. We need production relevance. So once NASCAR decided that it was their idea, then it happened. So come January, February at Daytona, you'll see these production. You'll see the new Chevrolet SS, which hasn't been formally announced yet, the Ford Fusion, the Camry. Of course, Dodge will be gone then, but the cars look really good.
Yeah,
because I mean, but to your point, I mean, it's the one sport where your major stars can die. I mean, they don't go out for a season or whatever. I'm just kind of surprised that they are the safety. You know,
there are safer barriers, which made a hell of a difference.
Which is like padding on the outside, on the walls of these ovals. So if you crash into them, you're not just going straight into
concrete. There have been several major hits in the last 5 years where if they didn't have safer barriers, they would have had a fatality. So that's a huge thing. That was actually the Indianapolis Motor Speedway commissioned the development of that. Now it's pretty much obligatory on ovals all over the country. You know, NASCAR's popularity has waned. They're about to sign a new contract with the TV networks. But when you have Talladega is traditionally NASCAR's there's like two places, Bristol, which is NASCAR's Woodstock, and Talladega. And their attendance have been down in those two key places where before didn't matter. You'd pack the joint. So NASCAR has intermittent vision. They will tell you, oh, we're visionaries, but they're only intermittently so. These new cars that are coming, that was forced by the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. They just said enough is enough. Because after Dale Earnhardt Sr. crashed and died, they did the safety package, and they said all the cars will look the same, they'll build the same, and we'll put decals on the front to indicate the different manufacturers. Well, they turned off the hardcore fans when they did that, because NASCAR was based on you're a Ford fan, you're a Dodge fan, you're a Chevy fan, you're a Plymouth fan. That was part of it. And it was a very regional sport, the Southeast. And then NASCAR, the France family, projected NASCAR around the country to some degree of success, but they're finding out in a lot of places it's not really working that great. California, they can't.
Yeah.
The California Speedway, they can't fill the place. I mean, they're not running there.
Right. And you, matter of fact, you and I both went to Bristol.
Yeah. Right.
So that was one of, as not, you know, I mean, again, a racing fanatic, that was one of the most amazing experiences
Bristol,
of my life.
Yeah, yeah, I've told everyone, if you go to one NASCAR race in your life, go to Bristol in the night race.
Right, right. It's that's not, what we were at.
I've never seen fans like that. I mean, there was a smog over, you know, I was trying to figure out what this sort of smog over this, over the whole area was, and it's campfires from fans that come in trailers and camp out for hundreds or thousands of miles away. I mean, it was this whole gathering. Yeah. I've never seen a fan base like that for any sport.
Yeah, and at its peak, it was pretty amazing. But they have found that things are changing. I mean, the fans aren't there. It's expensive. You know, you go to a NASCAR race, usually you have to pay for four nights in a hotel, prepay, and there's no cancellation fee. And so you're paying $300 a night for a Holiday Inn or a Super 8, and there's no cancellation fee. And, you know, but it's the lifeblood of this local economies.
Right.
But, you know, it's starting to take its toll. And the fact that it's on TV all the time, some people question, you know, maybe this oversaturation. Why would I want to go to the event? I can see everything, you know, on TV. So they're battling a lot of issues. But the issue they need to address is the restrictor plate racing. It's not racing, and they have to change it.
Yeah. Hey, we should probably take a commercial break right now and get our other guests to come on the show. So, Ben, why don't we give a shout-out there to our friends at Bridgestone? Well, now we've got Candace Wheeler, a technical fellow at General Motors, who is an expert in biofuels, so great having you on Out of Line After Hours.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So what's new in the biofuels whole arena?
There's a lot new. But first of all, I mean, we could just address the question of why have biofuels in the first place. A lot of people even wonder why we have biofuels. And, you know, it really gets down to the fact that there's, you know, 820 million vehicles in the world's car park, and that number is growing very rapidly. So by 2020, we'll have over a billion vehicles on the road. Just to put that in perspective, if you were to park those end-to-end, they would circle the globe 125 times. But 96% of those vehicles are dependent upon petroleum as their energy source, and it really isn't sustainable. So we really need to find an alternative to petroleum for those vehicles. And at GM, we really have a two-prong approach on how to, you know, reduce our dependence upon petroleum. First is to improve the efficiency of the vehicle. Certainly, you know, every gallon that you save is one less you have to import from somewhere else. And so that's great. We're coming out with a lot of new cars that have segment-leading fuel economy, so we're very excited about that. But the other way is to diversify the energy source. So certainly electric vehicles like the Volt play a great role in that, but biofuels is something that we can do today, use it in vehicles that are on the road today, and make a difference, you know, in the near to midterm while we're waiting for some of these other technologies to roll out in significant numbers.
Candace, I'm sure we'll talk about a whole bunch of these biofuels, but one that was getting a lot of coverage about 3 years ago was LG-based biofuel. it looked really promising. What's going on in that area?
Yeah, there's been a lot of hype around algae. Some of it, you know, deservedly, and some of it just hype. But, you know, when you look at getting an oil-based, you know, fuel like algae does, if you grow soybeans, you're going to get maybe 50 to 60 gallons of biodiesel off of an acre of land. If you grow DATROFA, which is a crop that you can grow on marginal lands, and it's a perennial crop, it grows so that you can harvest it every year without having to replant it, you can get maybe, you know, 500. So, you know, people
Wait,
that talk
60
about...
60 gallons for...
from an acre.
From an acre for soy and 500 from, how do you say that, DATROFA?
DATROFA, right. It's a perennial, it's actually a weed that grows in places like India, South America, and it hasn't really been commercialized, you know, domestically to grow it. But GM actually has a large project going on with DOE in India to look at growing DATROFA to get higher yields, to look at the agronomics of how best to plant it. Do you plant it and mound it up, or do you plant it, you know, from seed, or do you take cultivars and plant them? And, you know, but looking at things that have high yield, drought tolerance, salt tolerance, it can actually improve the soil over time. But the really nice thing is that if you look at it from a sustainability point, like I said, you know, it's a perennial crop, minimal farming inputs, and yet you can, you know, get a significant amount of oil. But if you take that a step farther and you look at algae, you know, people are predicting you can get 5,000. So now you go from 50 to 500 to 5,000 gallons per acre. The problem with algae is that it has just been too costly at this point. It's not competitive with gasoline or diesel fuels at this point. And there's a lot of number of reasons why that is. You know, they've looked at growing them in open ponds. They've looked at growing them in bioreactors and, you know, looked at all the differences there. But one of the biggest problems is just, you know, the harvesting. You've got all these small little algae in this great big lake. So how do you actually gather it, harvest it, de-wet it, and get the oil out? And people have been very creative. They've thrown in tilapia, and the tilapia eats all of the algae and then excretes a green goo, and then they just scoop up the green goo, right? You can kind of have a two-for-one there because you can have the fish and you can have the algae. But, you know, there's a lot of different things that they're working on to really improve, you know, just how it's done, but it's still too expensive. So, you know, we're seeing it, you know, going to the pharmaceutical industry, cosmetic industry, nutraceutical industry, but it'll be a while before it walks down the cost curve to become a commodity of biofuel.
Congratulations. It's the first time anyone has uttered green goo. From tilapia, no less, on Autoline After Hours. What about, did GM have a relationship with Cascada and that whole thing?
Right. Cascada is a what I call a second generation biofuel company. First generation being, you know, corn or sugarcane from Brazil. 1.5 generation I ascribe to things that are still sugar and starch based but are non-food based crops. So going to cassava, for example, or going to other DATROFA as an oil seed rather than soybeans. But then we get to the second generation, which is more the cellulosic ethanol, and you can have either a biochemical route or you can have a thermochemical route. And Cascada is a good example of the thermochemical route. And one of the really nice things about that is that it's very flexible on the front end. You can put anything in there, whether it's wood chips or, you know, corn stover or municipal solid waste. And that's one of the feedstocks that I think, you know, hasn't really been talked about. We talk about growing these energy crops, switchgrass, and other things, which are exciting and are coming, but, you know, municipal solid waste is something we collect every day. People put it out at the curb. It's already there. You either drive the truck to the landfill or you drive it over to Cascada and they make it into fuel. And so the average American actually throws away 4.5 pounds of trash every day, only 10% of which is ever recycled.
I've always said, if America can make fuel out of garbage, we will run the world.
Well, it would, and even if you took half of the garbage and made it in, you know, used Cascada and made it into ethanol, you can make 8 billion gallons of ethanol just from the trash we throw away. So it's something that certainly would be worthwhile doing.
Do they have a facility that's up and running, or...
Right. Their headquarters is in Warrenville, Illinois, but they have a demonstration plant in Madison, Pennsylvania, and that's been running since 2009. So they have been working very hard. They're now looking at building their first commercial plant. They were given a loan guarantee from the DOE, it's actually the USDA. And so they're looking at a plant in Alabama, but and they're also they're pretty flexible, so they can take any kind of feedstock. Like I said, what it does is it goes into a gasifier. The gasifier then turns it into carbon monoxide and hydrogen. And instead of using a catalyst, which some of the old technologies had, they actually use a microbe, and the microbe eats the carbon monoxide and the hydrogen and produces the ethanol. So it's a pretty exciting process because it's ethanol specific. You know, they only make ethanol and only ethanol. It's not a mixture of alcohols like some of the catalytic processes are. But yeah, they're moving forward with that. Moving forward.
So
with making...
do people believe in it? I mean, is this something that we could actually as a country embrace and nurture and develop so that we're, you know, not petroleum dependent necessarily?
Right. I think that it's a very credible technology, and I think it can be very cost effective. One of the things that they're looking at now is just because North America is awash in natural gas,
right,
using it as a feedstock, doing steam reforming on the natural gas to create the carbon monoxide and hydrogen that I talked about before, and using the same microbes to then convert it into a fuel. And that also is very cost effective process. So there's a number of ways that we can do that. I think that, you know, we had hoped that some of these technologies would be out into the marketplace a little sooner. The recession really dried up the funding, which was really the biggest concern. I mean, a lot of these companies had their demonstration plants up and running, were proving out the technologies, but now just can't get money to build that first plant. And it's very expensive to build a plant, you know. So it's hard when there's, you know, technology risk, there's risks on the feedstock side, there's risks on the offtake, you know, volatility in the oil prices, you know. And so when a banker, you know, looks at it, they go, you know, I just don't know. So the hardest part has really been trying to get capital to build those first plants. But there are several plants that are under construction. One is being commissioned this quarter, and it'll be online in the fourth quarter, producing cellulosic ethanol from waste streams. And I think that by this time next year, you know, with all of the plants that are under construction, we'll have over 100 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol being produced. So,
John, every time you comment on ethanol, I notice on Autoline Daily, you get all these cranks writing in.
Oh, I'm sure some of the cranks will be writing in tonight.
Saying ethanol.
It's so politicized. Yeah. They just...
Like ethanol won't work.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, right. Tell us, settle this. I mean, because, you always hear, it's this gigantic boondoggle. Ethanol, you know, growing it burns, you know, is worse for the environment than gasoline. There's
or it consumes more energy.
Energy than you get, and all this, and I just hear the only independent country on earth, I think, is Brazil, where they actually, you know, they're making ethanol work. Here in the U.S., you utter it now, it's become this just radioactive topic, and everybody just wants to stop it now. I mean, what's the difference? How has Brazil been so successful, and why do we hit so many roadblocks in the U.S.?
Well, there's a lot of history behind that. Brazil started in the 70s, you know, when there was the oil crisis, and then they never gave up. They just kept going on, whereas here, because the low oil prices, we stopped working on it, but they kept at it, and their government has been very supportive. I mean, a lot of the oil companies are government-owned, so that probably helps. But they've been very, very supportive in getting ethanol out into the marketplace. And making it from sugar was a very economical way to do it. And they still can do that. The last couple of years, they've had poor weather harvest in Brazil, and so their prices of sugar have gone way up. And so in the last couple of years, making it from corn has actually been cheaper than making it.
Is that right?
Yeah. So last year we exported 400 million gallons of ethanol, corn ethanol, from the United States to Brazil because they were short. And they actually, they have, instead of being E10, which most of the gas here in the United States is, they have E25, and they had to lower that to E20 because they were short on ethanol. But we actually exported, corn ethanol down there. So, it really has, but to get back to your question, there is a lot of misconceptions on ethanol. Ethanol is actually a very good molecule fuel-wise, and I'll talk a little bit about the efficiencies, because one of the things that bothers me is people say it's not very efficient, and it is, so we'll talk about that. But when we look at, growing it, there's always been the contention, it takes more energy to grow it than you get back in the fuel, and that's really not true. There was one study done by Pimentel, that was done a long time ago, and it really boils down to the fact that it used a lot of very old agricultural data. So I grew up a farm, right? So I remember my dad going out and plowing, and then he disking, and then draying, and then you have to go plant, and then you'd have to fertilize, and you have to, you went over the field half a dozen times, right? Just to get the crop in. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of fuel. But today, more than a third of the corn that's planted here in the United States is done no-till, which means the corn stalks are still on the field from the year before. They don't plow, don't do anything. They just go and
no kidding.
Plant.
When did that happen? When did that change come about?
Oh, it's been happening, and it's been gradually coming in over the last 10 years, and more and more. And, so from a sustainability reason, it's very good. From an environmental standpoint, you don't have, the runoff, the water loss, the
soil
wind.
Loss.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The soil loss from wind or water. And you don't have compaction of the soil from driving the tractors over the ground all the time. And so, there's been a lot of reasons to move towards no-till. And so almost all of the farming, at least a third of the farming is done no-till, which means you just go once and that's it. So, today's farming uses a whole lot less energy than Pimentel used in his model. So all of the new studies that are done, Michael Wang at Argonne National Labs has done some extensive studies using the GREET model and, show very clearly that there is, an energy gain in making biofuels, and it's significant. Corn ethanol still has a gain, not quite as much, but when you get to the cellulosics, it's huge that you have a very large energy gain.
Now, the corn that's used, is that the corn that we would eat on our table, or is it, more like a feed corn or something like that,
giant corn that you get in the can, or corn on the cob kind of corn. It's actually number two dent field corn, right? So, 99% of the corn that's grown in the United States is field corn, and it's used to feed animals, not people. I mean, you can grind it up and make cornflakes out of it. But when you look at what the corn that is, you drive through Iowa and you see those fields and fields of corn, that's number two dent field corn. And, half of that is going to field animals. Another 30-40% is now going to make ethanol. And then you've got 10% that goes to make all the food products, including a very large fraction, which is the fructose corn syrup, to put in the, Coke and Pepsi
or
even hamburgers.
Stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
And then, correct me now, so the food that the corn is being raised for ethanol, it's not going then to starving children. I mean, you're not pulling it out. It's actually stuff that would be fed to cows, which I think is like one of the most inefficient way to get food, right, is feeding corn to a cow and then eating it is probably not the best way to feed the world, right?
Right. And it's a very complex issue, right? I mean, most of the corn, even the corn that we export, goes to developing countries to feed animals. And now with the ethanol production, the ethanol process only uses the starch out of the corn. It doesn't use the protein or the oil or any of the other nutrients. So you have a byproduct that's called dry distiller grain that's left over when you get done making the ethanol. So we actually take that and we sell that to China and to other countries, to feed their animals. When I've gone to China, they now have a McDonald's on every corner because they're beginning to adopt a Western diet and they're eating more meat than they used to. And so they need to feed that. When we look at, grain going to people, it's really not an availability issue. It comes down to a poverty issue. There's a lot of grain in the world, and a lot of us eat way too much food, but there's other people who don't have enough food, And it's not really that we don't have enough food in the world to feed them, but, you know, because of poverty, they don't have access to that food.
So this food versus fuel argument is not as being overblown?
Oh, I definitely think so. You know, I mean, you know, there are issues, but when you look at how much corn is actually going to ethanol production, it only takes 2.9% of the global grain. So, you know, it's really a very small fraction of the total grain. We have a lot of grain to feed people. And one thing that people don't understand is that, you know, long ago, Iowa farmers were just way too efficient at growing corn, and so we put everyone else out of the market. That's what the tortilla wars were all about, the fact that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, their farmers couldn't compete.
In Mexico,
right? But now that corn prices have gone up a little bit, you see the rest of the world, you know, starting to grow their own food. And it's fascinating because, you know, when my grandfather was growing corn, he got 40 bushels to the acre, right? When my dad was growing, he was, you know, all the farmers were talking about who's going to get to 100 first, right? You know, now my brother-in-law farms and he gets 220 routinely, right?
Wow.
But, you know, the average in the world is still 70, right? And so if we can get other places in the world to take the hybrid varieties and use the agronomic practices that we use here, the amount of grain in the world could triple without using a single another acre of land. Monsanto did a fascinating study, and they went in to all different places in the world. And they planted, you know, their own field using their own seed their own way. They had native people plant it using their seed but their own way. And then they planted, you know, with the native seed in the native way. And they showed, you know, in Mexico, where still 71% of the corn is open pollinated, meaning, you know, you just save some from this year and plant the next year. It's not the hybrid biotech corn that we use here. You know, they're getting 50 bushels to the acre. Well, my brother-in-law is getting 220. So you can see that, you know, globally, Monsanto got 100 bushels more. So it really comes down to, you know, if we can get these varieties in the hands of farmers, help them to use them and develop the practices, there is enough.
Yeah, you know, you made a really good point that I don't think has gotten out. And I only learned it when I went to an ethanol refining plant. You called it a co-product, this distiller's grain that you feed to cattle. I didn't even know that it had existed. And sure enough, you know, leaving the plant are tanker cars full of ethanol and box cars full of distiller's grain that gets fed to cattle. And so when people are saying, oh, yeah, well, even if it's corn that goes to feed animals, we're still not feeding the animals, so our food prices are going up. I'm thinking, wait a minute, we've got this. In fact, at the refinery, they did not call it a byproduct. They called it a co-product because they get equal amounts of ethanol and distiller's grain.
Right, and it certainly helps the economics of the plant. So right now, corn prices have gone up with the drought in, you know, the Midwest. But, you know, by selling the distiller's grain, it really helps to offset the cost of the ethanol and keep the cost of ethanol low.
So, obviously, the internal combustion engine has a long way to go in terms of efficiency. I mean, every time we say, oh, we can't do any more, come up with something else. And General Motors has done a lot of research into, well, they've got the Bolt, they've been researching hydrogen fuel. They've been doing all kinds of things. Now the hybrids are the next thing. But do you think that cellulosic ethanol, it sounds like the U.S. government should get behind that in a huge way. I mean, instead of giving Henrik Fisker more money to do his personal, you know, boy toy car, I mean, they should be. Do you think cellulosic ethanol has the potential to be the long-term solution for our fuel? I mean, we already know we're not going to have a fleet of 100% electric cars. It's not doable, never was doable. So you think if cellulosic, the whole thing is guided properly, we could end up being in a much better position and using cellulosic ethanol throughout the country? Do you think that's possible?
Right, and certainly there are a lot of advantages to cellulosic ethanol. The corn ethanol is made in the Midwest, and then it has to be shipped all the way to the coast where most of the people live. And I see cellulosic as being able to take whatever product is in your region, making it into a fuel and using that fuel locally so that you don't have to ship it in big unit trains all over. So if you're in Georgia, you would take wood chips. If you are in, you know, Louisiana, you may take bagasse, which is a leftover from sugarcane. If you're in Tennessee, you'll grow switchgrass. If you're, you know, in Iowa, you use corn stover. But you can take those waste products, you know, from agriculture waste or forestry waste, and convert them into a fuel that you can then use locally. And so, you know, it has a lot of pluses. But, you know, I think that there is a push. There is right now one of the greatest drivers for, you know, the development of these advanced biofuels is the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS2. And in that, you know, it's a gradual increase in the amount of fuels going out to 2022 when you have 36 billion gallons. And one thing that I want to make clear is that corn ethanol is capped at 15 billion gallons. We made 14 billion gallons last year, so essentially we're already at the cap of corn ethanol.
And just, then it has to go to cellulosic.
And then it has to go to these advanced biofuels, one of which is the cellulosic biofuels. And so, you know, with the 15 billion gallons is corn ethanol, then the next 16 billion gallons is cut to come from the cellulosic portion. And so I think that there is a driver, if we hold firm on the RFS2, to push us to get to these advanced fuels that use waste products, don't use food, and make, you know, a fuel out of them, which I think is a great thing to do. And even the carbon, you know, the sustainability of those, the RFS2 is the very first law in the United States that actually has a carbon built into it, you know, a life cycle analysis into it. So corn ethanol has to reduce the carbon footprint 20% over gasoline. These cellulosic fuels have to reduce it by 60% over gasoline. And so, they all, you know, essentially do. Most of the Cascada process is a 96% reduction over, you know.
See, what I like about this, you know, to your point, Peter, about the government, you know, RFS2 is Renewable Fuel Standard. So by law, we've had to produce ethanol. Now we're going to have to, by law, produce cellulosic ethanol. And what I like, finally, instead of putting the whole onus of reducing CO2 on the backs of the car industry, we're saying, hey, fuel industry, you got to step up to this issue too. So I love what you're talking about there.
Right. And it doesn't stop with the cellulosics. There are other advanced biofuels that are coming online too that we will see. And, you know, ethanol has been great for substituting for gasoline, but we still need substitutions on the diesel side. When you have a barrel of oil and you put it in a refinery, you get a gasoline fraction, a diesel fraction, a jet fraction, and you need to substitute all of those fractions. And so being able to substitute diesel is also important, since the world is actually diesel short and long on gasoline. So, you know, there's a lot of new technologies that are coming out that will produce hydrocarbon fuels that are, you know, very similar to the petroleum-based fuels that we use today, that are indistinguishable. They can be put into the existing infrastructure, be used in the existing car fleet without any changes, and can be transparent to the customer.
But lower in carbon, right?
Right.
Has anyone tried anything with kudzu?
That's a great question.
Well, it's apparently the bane of the...
of the South.
South.
Yeah, geez, it's everywhere. Hey, look, why don't we take a quick commercial break here and then get into the rapid fire part of the show, because I know we're going to have a lot of questions from the audience. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
It's just...
Okay, we're back, and it's time for the rapid fire part of the show. Ben, let it rip. Boy, I think we've covered a lot of these questions that have already come in so far. You know, does it use more energy? Are we using up the food supply? Ethanol from garbage. Here's a good question. Jim from Sioux Falls wants to know, if you were driving a non-flex fuel vehicle and you put E30 in it, what would it do and how long would it take for any damage to occur?
We don't recommend that. The vehicles that we made, and actually, you know, one of the things that just came out in the press the last week is the fact that, you know, General Motors has been making our 2012 and 2013 model vehicles compatible with E15. So,
all of them?
All of them. So when we, you know, the EPA came out and was starting to look at, you know, E15 as a fuel. We used the depth of knowledge that we have with flex fuel vehicles and looked at what needed to be done to change the elastomers in that vehicle and to remodulate the control module, and have now, you know, all of our 2012 and 2013 models are E15. But older model cars were designed to take E10. So we recommend, you know, we want our customers to have a safe and pleasurable driving experience, and so we recommend that they do look at their owner's manual and use the fuels that are developed for those cars. Having said that, you know, we have a significant number of flex fuel vehicles. I know this question was about a non-flex vehicle, but, you know, we do have 7 million flex fuel vehicles that GM has produced on the roads in North America today out of the 11 million that are out there. And in those cars, you could put the E30 and not have problems, but we do not recommend putting higher blends in older existing cars.
So in this guy's cars, the seals rot out, the fuel leaks out, and the car starts on fire?
Right.
Or whatever.
Well, you know, ethanol is a more polar molecule, so it absorbs into the elastomers, right? And in the fuel tank, we didn't used to, you know, cover the leads, you know, insulate the leads, because gasoline is not a polar molecule. But, you know, since ethanol is, it sets up sort of a, you know, a plating into the fuel tank, so you can have problems. But, you know, there are a number of significant problems, you know, with ethanol in older vehicles, and so it's just not recommended.
Dan Sedgwick says, hey, how about asking those avant-garde Californians how they like paying $6 a gallon for their special blend of gasoline, for their special emission requirements, for their special cars that can only be processed in California? I think he's just making a point. He also goes on to say, I read somewhere that ethanol can be simply processed one additional step to be turned into isobutanol. And he says, I think one of the sports car series, Grand Am or American Le Mans, is already running some cars on this green energy fuel. Is he right in that?
Right. And, you know, there are a number of technologies that are actually taking older, distressed ethanol plants and converting them over and making butanol. So there are a lot of advantages and disadvantages to butanol. One of the advantages is that you can use it in higher concentration. Instead of being E10, you can go to a BU16. So you can go to a 16% butanol. It's got a 4-carbon molecule instead of a 2-carbon molecule, so it has a higher energy density. You know, you get a reduction in BTUs with ethanol. You do get a slight reduction with butanol, but it's less, so you have a higher energy density. But right now they're struggling. You know, Gevo and Butamax are two of the leading companies out there that are making butanol. And they started up, but, you know, their yields haven't been terrific, and they haven't gotten to the cost points yet. One of the interesting things, though, is that they can sell it into the chemical market, and they can get a higher price for it. Now, that's not going to get it in my vehicles right away, and I like low-carbon fuels. But, you know, what it does is it helps them to walk down the cost curve by selling it into the chemical market, and then eventually they can go into the commodity fuel market. But butanol can be a good fuel in the future. It has some downsides, though. It does produce more emissions from the tailpipe, you know, so there are other downsides with the butanol as well. And it doesn't have as high octane as the ethanol does. There are a number of different, you know, isomers of butanol, and isobutanol is not too bad, but n-butanol has, you know, lower octane.
Okay, Ben, I see we got a couple of phone calls. Let's bring one in here.
Hey, John, Ian Miller from Midland Park, New Jersey. I had to comment about Ford's resurgence and their actions going on in the past, say, 2-3 years from now. The Ford won, you know, one world, one, you know, one Ford thing that Alan Mulally's been doing for the past few years has really worked out. But one thing I have to say is that their market share has gone down. Well, they haven't gone down, but it's going down in terms of everybody else. Toyota, Honda, they're going up, and I'm really concerned for them in terms of what they may have to do in the United States and even in Europe to sell some cars. I mean, it's great that you're making a lot of money on each car, but you have to sell a lot of them to make some money.
He's overreacting. This is total overreaction to monthly sales figures. Ford's plan is solid, and they're going to continue to keep going.
And I'd say I'd add to that, Peter, in saying that Ford has shown really good discipline in not throwing incentives across the board, not trying to overproduce to gain market share.
Yeah.
So it's maintained a good balance. The guy's right. They have lost market share.
Well, I think Wall Street's reacting, too, and that might be driving some of his question.
Right.
But, I think that...
I think Wall Street's got it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're totally underinflating Ford, and, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Hey, Ben, let's bring in another phone call.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York, and this question is for Peter. You know, as you know, any Chrysler dealer has to get special training and pay a fee in order to sell SRT vehicles, and I assume they limit the number of SRT retailers on the market. My question is, should GM do something similar with Corvette, that is, pull it out from under Chevrolet and give all GM dealers in the market the right to apply for the right to sell Corvettes as long as certain standards are met? So in some areas, a Cadillac dealer could sell Vets, another Buick GMC dealer, you know, and other dealers, even, you know, still some Chevy dealers could sell them too. And the second question is, do you think this ever would happen? Thanks.
Hey, Jeff. You know, I've talked about this for a long time, probably ever since I started doing Auto Extremis, that, you know, the nurturing of Corvette is very intermittently targeted in GM. I mean, sometimes the leaders get it, sometimes they don't. I've advocated breaking Corvette away from Chevrolet, but, you know, that's anathema within GM. Which is understandable. I mean,
right.
But having Corvette going to only the very, very top dealers, to me, makes a lot of sense.
Interesting idea, especially like Cadillac and GMC. Too.
Well, I mean, let's face it, the new Corvette, there's going to be three of them, by the way, three models. The new Corvette is, again, creeping up in the price point. It's still going to be a value proposition. But, you know, we already have a ZR1 that's well into the six figures. And that's a whole different customer. And, you know, you have a new car with a world-class interior, by all accounts. It's every bit as nice as anything out there. And I would like to see Corvette get special treatment. And the Corvette customer be treated more, you know, it's a special car.
Mm-hmm.
And they deserve that. Will it ever happen? I don't know. GM's got a lot on their plate. I'd be shocked if it happened.
Yeah.
If I was running Chevrolet, I would... say, look, I don't even care if it's a five-star Cadillac dealer and the Chevy guy in the same little area is about a 2.5, then let the Cadillac guy, if he's going to do it right, that's all about doing it right. If you're going to take care of the customer right, then you should be able to do that.
But, well, remember, it was when Ralph Gilles was on the show, he let it be known. We're not going to let anybody just sell
the Viper. Oh, yeah,
you
have to come up with a lot of cash. And tools and training, and even then, they still might not let you do it.
Right.
So, and I think that's the right way to go.
I agree. And, you know, it was on the show where Ralph let that be known. It's all of a sudden become a big news story in the last couple of weeks, but you heard it here first months ago. Ben, let's keep the phone calls coming.
Yes, my name is Clarence Zurofsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, why does natural gas conversion cars and trucks cost so much money? Back in the 70s, I could have had my pickup truck converted to propane for about $800. Thank you very much.
Bye. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I can answer it, because back in the 70s, you didn't have the crash standards that we do today. And the cost of converting an engine to run on natural gas is negligible. It's not that expensive. The cost of having a fuel tank, and this is where it really gets tricky, and fuel lines that can meet the crash standards, front impact, rear impact, side impact, rollover, roof crush. And remember, this cannot leak at all. So you've got to have like a bunker mentality when you design this whole fuel system. And so, yeah, what are the conversions now? It's like $6,000 to $10,000 a vehicle. It's outrageous.
I didn't realize it was that much.
No,
I know it's certainly a lot more than $800. A
Honda Civic, compressed natural gas car.
Yeah.
The Honda Civic is $10,000 above the base Civic. Now, there's a few things that go along with the natural gas one, but that just gives you an idea of it. If you had greater volume, yeah, that would bring the cost down. But anybody out there listening, if you can figure out how to do a fuel delivery system for compressed natural gas, you're going to be a billionaire, because that's the real key of why they're so expensive.
Well, I think the net of this show is this country has not done enough to accelerate our, when we have technologies to investigate, technology to invest in, this country's done a piss poor job of it, I think. And because we should be a lot further along. I'm sure you would like to see us a lot further along.
Well, and my beef is that it seems now in America, every technology has to pick a political party.
Yeah.
You know, we have, if your batteries, if your wind power, you're Democrat, and the Republicans are going to go out and trash everything you do. And if you're natural gas, if you're hydrogen, if you're any sort of petroleum, then you're Republican, and then the Democrats are going to go out and trash everything you do. And I think ethanol is a perfect example of just getting so politicized that you can't make forward progress. And it's, oh, man.
I mean, if I'm the president of the United States and someone brings me a cohesive plan to turn garbage into fuel, then I'm all in.
You would think
there.
So.
Right.
You
I'm
would
all
think
in.
So.
If
yeah.
it keeps somebody from getting his ass blown off in Afghanistan for no reason, I'm all in.
Right.
I don't see it as a country. We have to stop doing this divisive stuff and just say, what's for the good of the country? Good of the country is, if we got technology that we're not using and it's there, sitting there, waiting to be developed, it has to be done for the greater good. What happened to that phrase? For the greater good.
Yeah.
You'd never know it these days.
And especially if you could make it out of garbage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, jeez. What's the downside of that?
Right.
Well, maybe if you're a shareholder of an oil company, there's a downside.
Well, you know what? You had your run.
Yeah.
And it was a great run. But it has to be brought to a close, because we can't be doing what we're doing. I'm sorry. It's just dumb.
I think we got another phone call. Let's bring that in right quick.
Hi, great show. Dr. Wheeler, this is Jonathan Brown, a big GM fan, but also a big fan of Toscata. And I'm looking forward to hearing what it's going to take to run our cars that have not been built to run on it, on that biofuel. From that particular facility that you discussed. I have General Motors products, 2008 Corvette Cadillac CTS, and want to know how much it would cost me to retrofit it to run on those fuels. Thank you very much. I know it's down the road, but it's still exciting. Thank you.
Probably not cost efficient, I would guess.
Right. It isn't really cost efficient to go in and try to retrofit another vehicle to make it into an E85. Now, you can take the Coscada fuel and blend it in at 10% and still be using it, so you can feel good about it in the car that you have. But it really isn't cost efficient to try to retrofit. There's too many other parts in the car that have to be changed that it just isn't effective. But we have a lot of great new cars that you can buy, so that they can be, you know, ethanol can be put in. So
will the new Corvette run on E85?
I don't think so. We have
the race version does.
The race one, yeah, exactly. But it's a special one.
But so you've got to do things with the valve seats, right?
Right.
You've got to have
fuel lines,
fuel pump.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that expensive to convert a car. if you do it from the factory, right? For somebody to go in and retrofit it.
It's only $200 or $300, right?
Right.
Is it that much? I thought it was even less.
Right. We use about $100.
Oh,
I was going to say $100, right.
But it's different from the factory. I mean, if you're out underneath your car, you got that line threaded through there? It's just not good. You know, it's just not good. Jonathan, go trade your fleet in.
Yeah, yeah. Time to get a new one. Ben, do I read this right? We have one more call.
Hello, panel. This is Youngblood from Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question for Dr. Wheeler. In the north here in Ohio, we're seeing a lot of interest in both CNG, compressed natural gas, and LNG, liquid natural gas. Could you give me the pros and cons of the future? I realize the LNG is just a liquefied form with more density. But if you could go deeper, I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Great show. Later. Bye.
Right. Well, thank you for that question. And, you know, certainly CNG has been one of the big topics that's been on everybody's mind, you know, with the new fracking technology and the ability to get, you know, so much natural gas here in the United States. We've taken, you know, the United States, and we're now the largest producer of natural gas in the world, which is amazing. And prices have fallen accordingly because right now it's pretty much stranded here. If you look at the $2 a million BTUs here, it's $8 in Europe because all of the terminals were for importing all the, you know, LNG, not exporting it outside. So, you know, we need to turn that around in order to start exporting some of it. But, you know, trying to look at what is the best use of natural gas is an interesting thing. So we recently did a study to look at, you know, should we take the natural gas and compress it? You know, how much energy does that take? What's the cost involved? What is the cost of converting the vehicle? You know, what does it do if we take the natural gas and we turn it into electricity and use it in the Volt? Or if we take the, you know, natural gas and we make methanol or ethanol out of it and make a liquid fuel out of it? And so it's very interesting to look at that, and I think it's something that will play out over time. Certainly, because compressed natural gas is cheap, it's something that, you know, we're very interested in looking at. Right now, the problem is the infrastructure. There's only 900 stations in the whole United States, so we think it's bad with E85 with, you know, 3,000, but, you know, there's just no stations. But I think what we'll see is that right now you have a lot of fleets, you know, the Postal Service or the FedEx vans will come back to the same point and fuel up. Then large trucks, you know, the cost of converting them is very quickly recouped, you know, because of the very large difference in the price between natural gas and diesel. So we start to see fleets and large trucks use CNG. And then we're introducing, you know, pickup trucks this next year. The 2013 Silverado and Sierra will be compressed natural gas vehicles. And so I think you'll start to see, you know, these vehicles starting to get in the marketplace, but it will take a while for the light-duty fleet to turn to really take over significantly just because of the infrastructure problems.
You're not a big fan of fracking, are you?
No, I think fracking's a game changer. I think fracking done properly is not harmful to the environment. It's got to be done properly. You know, 5 years ago, I was a believer in peak oil. I thought, because all the experts were saying, we're running out of oil and it's going to go to $150 a barrel, which it did. And then they said, now we're going to $300 a barrel, and I believed it. Fracking and horizontal drilling come along, and here, in 5 years' time, it's totally changed the entire energy outlook. So I am actually a big fan of fracking, but it's got to be done properly. And part of the reason it has not been is we've had a lot of wildcatters run into the business to make a quick buck. Nothing's been regulated. So, hey, here's a time where I am in favor of regulation, provided they don't go overboard, as is tending to be the case in this country. But I think it's a game changer. I think it's our opportunity to get off OPEC oil before this decade is over. And, what that could do to our national security, what it could do to our trade deficit, what it could do to the growth in the economy, watch out. I think it's going to happen, and it's going to happen quick. And like I said, because 5 years ago, I was one of those who believed it was peak oil time. So, to answer your question, and with that, we ought to wrap it up.
Yeah.
This has been a great show. Candace, thanks for coming on. We could have gone on a whole nother hour. I know we only just scratched the surface here, but you got us to ask you a lot of the questions that I think the country's asking, especially all about ethanol. So thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks. Yeah, Drew, great having you on board, too.
Yeah
it's Drew.
Been really good.
Good to see you.
John. Peter, good seeing you, man.
Yeah, great to see you, John.
And let's do it again next week.
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.